Jeff Bryan was Army chaplain with the 4th Battalion, 31st Infantry. He shipped out of Fort Drum, New York. He still remembers the moment when they were all together, preparing to head into Iraq.
My commander said before we left that this is the last time where we will probably stand together as this group. And so we knew that, we were prepared, and then when we went in, you know, he told us that it's going to be a long, hard, bloody fight, but we'll do it, we'll win, and we'll come home.
They did not all come home. Chaplain Bryan says he held way too many memorial services while he was stationed in Iraq. The day he remembers most vividly was the morning, 1 year ago today, when a position was overrun, 5 men were killed, and 3 U.S. soldiers were taken captive. 2 of those men are still missing. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Story.
The Story is produced by North Carolina Public Radio, WUNC. It's co-produced and distributed by American Public Media.
It was still early morning, still dark, on May 12, 2007, when a team of U.S. soldiers in Iraq had its position overrun. 5 were killed and 3 soldiers were taken captive by insurgents. The ambush and the subsequent search were immediately in the news.
It's not the first time that this area, also known as the Triangle of Death, has been the scene for a complex...
U.S. and Iraqi soldiers are looking for any sign, even using their bare hands under bushes, for 3 missing U.S. soldiers in Iraq.
You know, in the United States military, we have a thing called the Soldier's Creed. And it says, I will never leave a fallen comrade. It's one of our 4 tenets that we all live by. And to every... a man and woman out there serving in uniform here in Iraq from the United States. We believe in this deeply.
10 days later, the body of one soldier, Private Joseph Anzac, was pulled from the Euphrates River. However, there was still no word on the whereabouts of Private Byron Foudy and Sergeant Alex Jimenez. The parents were left to watch and wait.
He's alive. But when you're watching TV, you can see everything, and they're looking for him and everywhere. And I say, oh, my God, where is my son? Terrible.
Now it's 1 year later, and there is still no word on the whereabouts of the 2 missing soldiers. Jeff Bryan was chaplain for the 4th Battalion, 31st Infantry, and he was not far away when news of the attack came down the line.
I was south on that road, about half a mile. It was about 5:30 in the morning, and I heard some rustling. And then about maybe 30, 40 minutes later, I did wake up, and I just had this eerie feeling something wasn't right. And so as I went outside to shave and brush my teeth, I remember there was a lieutenant there from Delta Company. He said, did you hear what happened? And my heart sank, and I thought, wow, oh, man, you know, we lost another guy. And then he said, no. We had a position overran. And then the feeling of utter shock, like, that's not funny, man. That's just not even funny. You know, and you're wanting to believe this guy's joking. And he told me right now, they've got a whole lot of people on the way to search for our guys. And I just remember thinking, wow, you know, they're probably waking the President of the United States up for this right now. This is so, so significant of an event.
At the time, Chaplain, what did you know about the number of men who had been killed or the number of men who were missing?
All I knew at the time was there were 2 vehicles, they were on fire, and it was just chaos.
What was it you eventually found out?
That both vehicles were overran, and we had 8 guys that were casualties. 3 were captured, and the other 5 were killed, and... the 3 were taken handcuffed and dragged off to trucks and were missing. Eventually, a week later or so, we found Anzac.
That was one of the men who'd been captured, right?
Yes.
And the other 2 that were captured, what do we know about them?
We knew they were captured. As we speak right now, I know there are men over there right now looking for them. We've found bits and pieces of things, but nothing conclusive of where they're at.
Wasn't there some report from Iraq that the men had been killed, that their dog tags had been found?
Yes, they found their ID cards, and I'm not sure where they found them. There was one video, I believe, that had a little white crucifix in it, and I gave him that crucifix.
So what are you thinking? Are you thinking that those guys are still alive?
You know, I will never give up hope. I won't believe they're dead until we have proof of that. Some people call me unrealistic for believing that there's any way that they could be alive. And, you know, we had prisoners of war in Vietnam alive for 5 years, 7 years, and our men could be alive somewhere. As a man of faith, I promised myself that. I will not give up. Sure, your faith does wear tired sometimes, but we just found Keith Maupin. He wasn't alive, but we found him, and that was 4 years. 4 years later.
Chaplain, did you get a chance to go up to the scene of where that position had been overrun?
It was kind of a strange progression up that road that morning, because the whole time I had been thinking about all my men, the faces, the men that I had been with, and what they must have been thinking, and how was I going to deal with it. And as I got there, I got out of the vehicle, I started walking, and there were pretty much two burned vehicles. And, you know, and blood spatter on the ground and trails, footprints, and it was a mess.
I realize that it's your job to go to places like that, and that it's your job to help the soldiers who have survived incidents like that make sense of it, but what's it like for you?
Some might not feel comfortable with the chaplain saying it's difficult and exhausting and traumatic, but, you know, if you care about your soldiers, I think anybody would feel that way. But looking back, as terrible as a day that was, I wouldn't go back and not be there. You know, we lost at least five guys from different units around Iraq that came down there to help us look for them. And, I think the sacrifice, even in the midst of looking for our guys, is just incredible. And there was a handful of men that came up to me, and they were all the men that were left of that platoon. And, you know, I didn't even have to go find them. They walked right up to me. That just shows the connection we had. Now, I'd been with other Delta Company platoons that morning. But this was the guys that could have been right there with those guys and slept with them and lived with them and ate with them. And
how were they doing?
You know, pretty rough, pretty rough. It was just a horrible day for everybody. I think about as bad as it gets. I just saw it in their eyes. And I ended up later going on missions with these guys. And, you know, with that tucked away inside that hurt, they just continued to keep going and do what we had to do until the day we got home. And for that, I always look back at those guys and say, wow, those are incredible men. And I remember my colonel telling me early on in the deployment, you know, the American soldier just doesn't even understand himself what he can go through. And going through what we went through is pretty bloodletting. And our men never, they just never quit.
I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Story. Jeff Bryan still considers that day to be one of his worst as an Army chaplain. He still has a shell casing from one of the Iraqi rifles that he picked up off the ground on that day.
It was an AK-47 round discharged onto the ground.
Why did you pick that up?
You know, I thought, as much as I don't want to remember this day, I think I'm going to take something and just stick it in my pocket. A reminder that God can bring people through anything.
And 1 year later, where's that shell casing now?
It's in a little wooden chest that I brought back. You know, I haven't even been through that since I've been back, but it's got all kinds of little memorabilia, like pieces from Iraq. But it just reminds me that if I could ever make it through that day, there's nothing I can't make it through.
Chaplain Jeff Bryan spent over a year in Iraq on that tour. He says he made it a point to travel with the soldiers on foot at the front line, and that it was often dangerous. Jeff says as chaplain, he had to be prepared to hold a service at any place at any time. He once did five such services in 2 weeks. Once, though, soldiers with a tank unit had lost three men, and they wanted a memorial service on the spot.
So they sent their tanks up, and they said, will you do a ceremony for us? And I said, I don't know if I can do one out here, because there's a lot of protocol that you have to go through, you know, to do one of these things. And in the end, me and my assistant said, you know, I mean, what are we going to get in trouble for honoring Americans that fell in combat? And it wasn't a large ceremony. I mean, a guy found me a flag from I don't know where. And then we stuck a little board on the ground, put three tanker boots in front of it, sandbags, stuck some rifles with bayonets and helmets on those. And then I basically just wore what I wore all the time, my helmet and my body armor. Told the guys, I said, hey, man, I'd been going out to that area since our unit went out there and had been shot at and blown up enough times to where, you know, you just know anything can happen anytime.
Was there anything that happened in that particular field ceremony that made you think that it really made a difference to those guys who were alive, that it made a difference to them that you were out there doing it in that way under those circumstances?
Yes, sir. At the end of that, we all kind of got a group photo, and Sergeant First Class said, hey, you know, sir, I've been in this unit since I was a private in Desert Storm. And he said, I've only received one coin from a commander ever, and I want to give you that. And it was a little commemorative coin in the shape of a tank sprocket. I said, I ain't got nothing to really give you guys, but I took the two crosses off part of my uniform. I gave one to Eads, and I gave one to Sergeant Scarhus. You know, I just always thought, hey, you know, maybe just knowing that it's a cross off my uniform, that it's a blessing to you somehow.
Chaplain Jeff Bryan says he wasn't always sure about his place in war as a man of faith. This was his second stint in the Army. The first time, he'd carried a gun, and it hadn't worked out the way he'd hoped, and we'll talk about that in just a moment. I'm Dick Gordon from American Public Media. This is The Story. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Story. Jeff Bryan is an Army chaplain who returned about 6 months ago from his time in Iraq. While he was there, a team of soldiers with his company was overrun, and several men were captured by the insurgents. It happened on May 12, 2007, 1 year ago today. And Chaplain Bryan is here to talk about his hopes that the two of those U.S. soldiers who remain missing may yet be found. He still remembers what it was like to ship out from Fort Drum with the 4th Battalion.
You can't really comprehend what combat entails because it's really the unexpectedness in combat that's the most challenging part. You expect to lose soldiers. My commander said before we left that this is the last time where we will probably stand together as this group. And so we knew that. We were prepared. And then when we went in, I think we had an idea of fighting more of a direct enemy than kind of like a guerrilla force like we did.
Pretty chilling to have the commander put it in those terms, though. I mean, you look left and you look right and you think, who and when?
It was. It's still fresh in my mind, but I do believe that part of getting through it was that our commanders had prepared us. You know, he told us that it's going to be a long, hard, bloody fight, but we'll do it. We'll win and we'll come home.
It was the kind of inspirational talk that appealed to Chaplain Jeff Bryan. He'd imagined himself somewhere on the battlefield ever since he was a kid.
The real heroes to me were my uncles, who almost all served in World War II. And I would go to libraries and I would get books and I would just look at pictures of, I remember there was a series, Time Life series on Vietnam or World War II or Korea or even the Civil War. And I would look at those and just be in awe of these young guys in war that, you know, weren't really, it just didn't look like they were getting anything back of it, but they were doing something for each other. You know, a picture of a guy reaching down to help a wounded soldier, but the guy has got so much energy as he was reaching down out of concern. And so I said, hey, you know, maybe I have whatever it is those guys have.
But Jeff Bryan's first enlistment didn't turn out the way he'd imagined. He joined up on January 3rd, 1991. That was 2 weeks before the first Gulf War started. Well, that war was over before he was even out of basic training.
I know it sounds naive, but I was naive. I was an 18-year-old kid that really didn't understand war. I tried to go to war, didn't work. I kept trying to go to different places. You know, I was in Korea when Somalia broke out and sitting over there watching it on TV going, now why couldn't we be there to help those guys out? That's what we train for, but we can't do it. It depends how you look at it, that flying around at 18 and 20 years old in a helicopter with night vision goggles and a machine gun on the other side of the world was pretty exciting. But, you know, you come back and then you just train and sit around and train and train and train. You never get to really find out what that is. Then maybe it's not so great. And then Somalia happened. I didn't go. Bosnia happened. I didn't go. And so I finally decided, you know, I think I'm not going to go. And so I got out of the Army, kind of disappointed.
Sounds like you were a little lost back then.
Very lost, yes. I was an angry young guy. I could do my job in the Army well. I just didn't feel like I was getting to do my job. I felt like I was just spending it all training and wasting my energy.
So what were you like? Were you a troublemaker?
I was a fighter. I drank a lot. But I could do my job, so the people in the Army really didn't see me as a troublemaker. I think after a few years of that and drinking really out of control, feeling like I'm not sure my life is not real great, but I don't know what to do with it. I tried, and I'm not sure where it goes now, so I just got out of the Army and got a little job and hung around.
If your first experience with the military was, you know, kind of not great as you've described it, why would you ever think to come back?
You know, I think one of the issues was I tried to make the military my life. Understand that in the military, sometimes patches and what's on your uniform is like God. You know, it's the more you get of it, the more powerful, the more cool you are. And I guess if your heart really believes that, then you really are a lost soul. And that's what I believed. I'd been raised from basic training. You know, the people that were my heroes, I suppose, at least within the military at the time, you know, were the guys with all the gizmos and ding-dong badges on their uniforms. And I saw that as, wow, that's really awesome.
So you had to outgrow that, is what you're saying.
I had to outgrow it. But I think when you try to make that your life, especially rather than just a job,
yeah,
it leaves you twice as empty. You know, it's like if your car is out of fuel, then you're out of fuel. But if you try to put dirt in the tank, it's only going to make it worse. And that's what I tried to do. And so when I got out of the Army, you know, I was just kind of hanging out, working a little job. And a guy ran into me. He kept running into me. You know, I didn't know anybody in that city, Clarksville, right outside Fort Campbell, Kentucky. All my friends were in the Army or gone. And this guy kept running into me in different places around the city. And he was a very huge guy. But he would come up to me and say, hey, you know, maybe I get a chance to talk to you. How are you doing? My name's Dino. And I couldn't figure out what he wanted to do with me. And it made me feel like, is this guy some kind of undercover policeman? You know, is he a cop? Why does he keep running into me? And eventually I was in a store, and about the third or fourth time I said, all right, dude, listen to this. Give me your number. And I remember telling a girl in the store that I worked at that, hey, you know, if I disappear or they find my body, you know, make sure you tell somebody something.
It's this guy, right?
So the guy came over, and I had a bat. I had a loaded 380 semi-automatic pistol that I said I carried and all kinds of other things around my apartment. And he came over and, you know, basically told me the love of Christ. And that's when I let that in, and my life changed. And after that, I felt in my heart that ministry was what I was supposed to do, was to go out and serve people, serve the Lord.
That's what Jeff Bryan did. He wound up preaching in California. And then after 9/11, people started suggesting to him that he should take his ministry to the men and women in uniform. I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Story. Jeff Bryan wasn't convinced that he had either the interest or the stuff to be an Army chaplain.
People had brought it up to me throughout the years. They said, well, hey, you really need to be a chaplain. You're a military guy. I said, don't tell me about the military, because you either haven't been there or I was an infantryman. And man, you know, it's all about that, not chaplains. I thought, now why do I want to go be kind of a dry religious, you know, somebody that hands out candy and just says, God bless you, and lets all the soldiers leave and I stay and, you know, warm up a chapel. And I remember thinking, I'm not going to let anybody talk me into being a chaplain because, you know, when I was in the enlisted, I maybe saw my chaplain 3 times. He never ran with us on physical fitness. I don't remember him being in the field. And so I thought, wow, I'm too much of a soldier. I'd want to be out there with him. So I waited, and in 2002, my mom introduced me to this guy. He was a Veterans Administration chaplain named Chaplain Gary Sanford. He was in Vietnam as a chaplain. He was Desert Storm as a chaplain. Just an incredible, incredible man. And so I started considering it and praying about it. I realized, wow, this is what I'm supposed to do, because I can take that love for soldiers, the love of God for soldiers, and I believe I may go to those forsaken places. All those books that I'd read as a kid, I think it comes around now. You know, what about the chaplain that jumped in on D-Day? I met one of them a couple years ago. His name is John Lindell. He was the first chaplain in my denomination, and he jumped in on Normandy with the men. And, you know, I've met chaplains from every war all the way back to World War II.
So what was it that you knew about the role or the responsibility of the chaplain, that it was up, basically up to you to decide how close to the front you wanted to be?
It all depends on your unit. Because obviously if you were a chaplain to an administrative unit or a motor pool, you may not be called to that front.
Yeah, but you didn't have to wear body armor. You didn't have to put a helmet on when you were in Iraq. You could have stayed back from the front line, couldn't you?
Well, yes and no. You always had to wear the body armor.
Yeah.
But you're right. I remember one of the things that spurred me on, I have to be honest, is that my commander said, whoever the last chaplain was, really didn't like to go out that much when given the opportunity.
Tell me something, though, Chaplain. When you were out in the field, did you carry a weapon?
I've never carried a weapon. I've honestly never carried one.
Is that your choice or is that policy?
It's both. I had the opportunity, you know, I've had a couple soldiers, you know, offer to give me weapons, and I had to turn it down because I told them, I said, I felt like it disqualified my being out there. Because you see, if I take that weapon up, it takes me out of the non-combatant status. And those arguing that chaplains are just another rifleman, you know, maybe they would have a reason, you know.
So even if you're with a group of guys who are badly outnumbered?
Yes. I've been in some really small groups of guys on patrols. And I don't know if that was the best thing to do looking back now. But in the end, I never carried the weapon. And
yeah.
I always had a bodyguard, you know, I had my assistant with me. And I always felt like the men who I were around, I'll give you an example. We were at a battlefield position one time, and we only had like maybe 12 or 13 people at this little battlefield position. And we got a call that sources in a local area were telling us 145 Al-Qaeda were going to come through and basically clear us out that night. And so I felt safe with all the guys I was around. I didn't feel safe with the situation.
Yeah.
But chaplains would tell me, you can't let nothing happen to you because you're an asset.
So aside from the fact that you're not carrying a weapon, what is it that identifies you as a chaplain?
You know, I mean, I have crosses on me, sort of, but I try to make it very obvious to my men, but not something that's like a flag on the top of my head. I wanted all the attention from my men, but none from the locals. I didn't really go out to other sheiks and meetings with those people. I didn't want anything drawing heat on me or anybody else.
I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Story. Chaplain Jeff Bryan was with the soldiers when word came down that their year-long deployment was being extended to 15 months. He says that was hard on everyone.
Maybe the 10th or 11th month, we found out that it was going to be extended an extra 3 months.
Do you remember what that was like?
Yes. It didn't go over too well for really anybody, but you just got to finish what you're doing, and nobody liked it. I didn't like it. You don't want to stay there a day longer than you have to, but if we can finish it and then go home, hoping somewhere that you can finish the job so that others don't have to replace you. One chaplain told me, if you want the best ministry, go to where it sucks the worst for soldiers. And I thought, you know, being out on a dismounted patrol going through a village that has never had Americans, it's ran by Al-Qaeda, and you're going to go in there and basically take it back from them in 130-degree heat, the risks are pretty high. But I just simply was trying to be a chaplain with them, and we went with tank units. We were in firefights with our men. We were getting blown up.
You're listening to The Story. I'm Dick Gordon. One time, the unit that Chaplain Brian was with had just taken a few Iraqi houses. Jeff and his assistant thought that they could move up to one of these new battlefield positions. They stopped at the first one, said hello to the soldiers there, and went to get back in their car when their commander stopped them.
This is a really large, tough-looking guy. And I remember just as clear as day, he looked at us and was like, "Where are you guys going?" And we said, "Sir, we're getting back in there to go out to the new places with you." And he's like, "Oh, man, that road's pretty bad. Why don't you stay here and then go out there tomorrow?" Obviously, we were disappointed because we wanted to see the guys. But we said, "Okay, sir, no problem. So we'll stay here and go out tomorrow." He smiled, laughed, and just had this amazing peace over him. And we looked at each other. He got back in the vehicle. It was a very beautiful day, you know, quiet. They started to drive off. And about 10 minutes later, we heard the boom. And it was a significantly large boom. You hear IEDs every day, sometimes numerous times a day, aircraft bombs, all kinds of things. This was a large, large explosion. I looked at my assistant, and he looked at me, and we just said, "Uh-oh, this is really bad." And it turned out that pretty much they had stuck 80 pounds of explosives plus two anti-tank mines under the road and blew it up. And I mean, if you could figure what one anti-tank mine designed to blow up a 50-ton tank would do to a tank, well, this little Humvee, you know, even with 500-pound doors, was just disintegrated. It blew it in half. The guy sitting behind my colonel died. And pretty much, you know, that was my seat often right behind him there. It blew him out, and he had to be medevaced out, you know. Thank God my colonel lived.
How many people were killed all told?
On that incident, one. Yeah. I think there were three wounded and one killed.
You know, I'm just sitting here listening to you tell that story and wondering if there were times when, you know, you'd get really angry at the insurgents and maybe beyond the insurgents at the Iraqis for the way that you would see your own soldiers being killed day after day.
Yeah. I mean, honestly, you do get angry.
So you're the chaplain. What do you do with that?
You just have to learn how to channel things. You just got to control how you show it, because soldiers watch everything you do, everything. So your attitude is really the biggest thing that you have to watch as a leader. You don't have to like something. You can hate something. You can hate people. I've had to carry my men's bodies and put them in helicopters, and I've had my men die every imaginable way over there. And it doesn't make me like the people we're fighting anymore, you know? But with my soldiers, I have to just control myself, and I cannot let that anger consume me to where I'm so hateful I have no control. Because honestly, it's the chaplain out there that is the one who says, "Hey guys, we're human beings, you know, and these guys were close to us all. And we just got to be careful, because see, the enemy in this type of fight wants you to retaliate and go shoot civilians. That's what they want you to do, because more civilians will turn against the United mm-hmm. States, right? And, you know, sometimes you tell that to a guy, and a week later, somebody near him would die again. And sometimes you feel like, wow, you know, how many times can I tell these guys this? But I found that, Dick, it's not just telling them, it's living it.
Yeah.
It's so much more living it as a leader, saying, you know what? I hate half these people out here, you know? Because I know the people that were in this village with this incident of capturing my men, I know they were related, but they want to lie to us and tell us they don't know what happened.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Chaplain Jeff Bryan says he lost some close friends in Iraq as well. And when that happened, it was also on his shoulders to do the memorial service. We'll talk about how that affected him in just a moment. I'm Dick Gordon from American Public Media. This is The Story. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Story. Chaplain Jeff Bryan recently finished up serving 15 months in Iraq. He was attached to the unit that included Private Byron Foudy and Sergeant Alex Jimenez. Those are the two soldiers who were kidnapped 1 year ago, two soldiers who remain missing today. Chaplain Bryan says he believes those two men may be alive, and it's his duty to remember them. However, it was also his duty to conduct many memorial services while he was posted in Iraq.
I lost a lot of people close to me. I knew every single soldier that I lost. Now, some more than others. The one closest to me would probably be Sergeant Christopher Mezer. He'd been in Iraq before. He was in Fallujah, and he'd won a Purple Heart. I met him in Iraq at a little battlefield position because, remember, I was pretty new to my unit. I didn't have a whole lot of time before I left to get to know everybody. And, there was only about 9 or 10 guys there. So I spent the day hanging out with them. It rained. It was cold. And we talked and we talked and we talked. And you know, Dick, we built a relationship that changed my life forever. This brave young guy frequently told me that he was going to die.
He thought he was going to die in Iraq.
Yes. He said, "I'm going to die here." And I said, "You can't think like that, man. You know, you got to have faith and we're going to be all right." And he kept telling me, he said, "Sir, I'm going to die here. I've been hit one day like 4 or 5 times in one day by IEDs. Mm-hmm. And I'm not going to make it through this." And I prayed with him. He gave his life to the Lord, just an incredibly strong faith. But that just didn't seem to leave, you know. And so on December 26th, him and a group of guys went out to burn some reeds, and I think some ammunition started cooking off in the grass from the fire, and so they backed off and said, "We'll come back later." They came back the next morning. That morning was Sergeant Mezer's 4th wedding anniversary, and they went back out there, and they were ambushed. There was somebody from that local village had set an IED out waiting for them, knowing they were going to come back, and it killed Given, a private that was with him, instantly, and Sergeant Mezer was blown in half. He lost both his legs and was alive for a brief time and then died en route to the medevac.
Did you do a memorial service for him?
I did.
So are some harder than others, like that one?
Yes. That was really difficult because, the last time I saw that guy was sometime in December, and I looked at him and popped him on the shoulder and said, "Hey, I love you, man. Keep your faith up and you're going to be all right?" And I got out of the vehicle. He smiled and laughed and just kind of went on with guard duty. And that's the last time I ever remember seeing him alive.
So tell me something, Jeff. Do you ever feel like in any way you let him down or his own faith let him down?
I don't feel that his faith let him down. I feel like his faith, you know, he told me that you're the only peace I have here. You know, this is my peace. Like my wife said, maybe he really knew what was going to happen somehow, and maybe his faith is somehow, you know, the one piece that got him through each day to even walk back out there. But I feel like I didn't really let him down, but I wish I could have had more time with him. Mm-hmm. As with all my guys, you pat a guy on the shoulder and smile at him, and sometimes that's all that guy could ever ask for, is to see a chaplain and ask for a little blessing or prayer. I knew everywhere I went all the time that that moment when I get out of vehicle and I see soldiers, I just look at them and they smile like, wow, the chaplain's here. That was their peace and blessing in a strange way. I knew that also every second I wasn't out there was a second I didn't have with them. And regardless of what happened to me, it was worth the risk to go do that because that's what I'm there for. And that's what my faith is. If my faith is, God bless you when I sit back in a chapel and let you guys go do the hard stuff, then I'm not really sure how deep that is. But when I was out in the vehicles and the road would explode and part of your vehicle sitting there, you're like, man, this is the real thing. And so you just kind of pray and react.
When you see guys like Sergeant Messer being killed and all the other soldiers who you knew over there, whose memorial services you did, and when you saw the, you know, the Iraqis who you would have seen dying over there, did you ever think to yourself that the whole darn thing's just a waste? That I'm not talking about, you know, should the war have taken place or what does the U.S. do now? But I just wonder if in that little microcosm that you lived in, you'd say to yourself, what is all this for?
You know, I have thought of that. I really have. Sometimes necessary sacrifice, I think, is a waste of life, because I could certainly think of the, I don't even know how many men we've lost at this point, over 4,000. In a way, it is a waste of life, but I don't say that the effort was wasted, because I believe these guys all knew what they were doing. The political side of it, I don't think is wasted, but on human life terms, even if you went back to D-Day, I don't know who could honestly say that 2,500 men on a beach was not a waste of life.
Chaplain Jeff Bryant's been back in the U.S. now for about 6 months. In that time, he's made it a point to stay in touch with parents of the soldiers who were captured, soldiers that remain missing.
I spent a while with Mick Foudy, Byron's dad, and I gave him a little card that the men that replaced us from the 101st gave me. When they got on the ground there, I think it was the first night, their command was in there having dinner in a little chow hall we built. And I was in there and I was just sitting there quietly thinking, you know, recollecting about the near end of my deployment and these guys that were replacing us and what it all meant and where it was all going. And I remember sitting there and two of their command people were sitting there and they asked me something about it. And, you know, my eyes kind of watered a little bit. And I said, you know, that's what I'm thinking about is our men, Foudy and Jimenez. And the first one pulled out a card, and it had their pictures on it. It had a picture of Alex and Byron on it. And it said, American Heroes, May 12, 2007, never forgotten. We will always look for you.
These are the soldiers who were coming in to replace you. They didn't know these guys.
Right. And they gave me this card, and they said, I just want to promise you, for the next 15 months, this is our priority right here, is finding these men. And wow, you know, I didn't know what to do. I stuck it in my pocket and kept it, and I held on to that until I came back. The day I was sitting down with Mick Foudy, Byron's dad, you know, I showed him that card, and he was like, wow, you know, can I have that? So I gave it to him, and I told him, I said, hey, these guys are looking for your men right now. I didn't tell him that 12 hours after I got on a flight out of Iraq that the guy that handed me that card was a casualty. You know, him and five other guys were badly injured, and one was killed. Four of them, I think, were medevaced out. But I did tell him, I said, hey, you know, it's true, they are looking. And, you know, I found an article from the Army Times not long after that that they were doing these missions over there looking for him, and they found their weapons. They found Jimenez's saw, his machine gun, mm-hmm. and a couple other things. And so the search goes on, and hopefully we'll find him one day.
Jeff Bryant is back on base at Fort Drum in New York State. That's where he was when I talked with him. And thanks to David Summerstein, who helped out with the technical side of the recording. We have a number of photos and more information on our website. You can find photos of the men who are missing, the memorial scene that we discussed, and also a photo of that shell casing that Chaplain Jeff Bryant has kept with him for the past year. Thank you. This past Friday, we heard a story from Carolyn Parks about being a mother at age 13 and always bearing the guilt about what she was able to give her daughter as such a young mother. Carolyn talked about one day when she was so lonely, she dragged out her own old set of paper dolls and played with them.
And I did. I dragged my paper dolls out, my old paper dolls from a home, and started playing with them. And I was really, really embarrassed. In fact, I closed the curtains. And that day, I just, you know, played like girls play with their Barbies.
We got a number of letters from you after that, stories of family reunions and reconnections that made a difference in your life, and also moments about listening to the radio. Andrea wrote about bringing her daughter to a friend's house on the evening when the story aired in Michigan and how she started listening to Carolyn Parks and wound up sitting in her car until the end of the story. The response reminds me of another story about mothers and stepmothers. The whole time when Lisa Morgan and her siblings were growing up, there was a stark divide between two households, that of their birth mother and that of their stepmother.
My siblings were all bathed when they got there. We took off our clothes from my mom's house, and they went in a box. And most of our clothes were garage sale clothes at my mom's. And we would change into new, brand new Kmart clothes with embroidery and stuff. Garanimals, preferably, so that you knew what matched what.
So what's the message to you as a child, that everything that you have and everything that you bring from your mother's house is somehow unclean and needs to be deposited at the door? That's kind of a horrid message to give to a child, but then there's that other part where, oh, look, now we're getting new clothes with the stepmother.
Exactly.
It must have been really confusing.
Exactly that sort of tug and ambivalence. But because I was 13, and I just think it's a disastrous to even try to stick, you know, a teenage girl with a new mom. I just think it's a recipe for disaster. I've never heard it work out well.
How did your mother and stepmother allow you to describe those houses? Did you have two homes? How was that done?
As kids, the four of us just automatically said home for my mom's house and dad's for my dad's. When my stepmother came on the scene, she said, no, I don't want you doing that anymore. That hurts your dad's feelings. This is your home, too. You can call this home, and you can call the other one, how about you call that the house or the big house or the white house? So officially, they were both home. But when we said, when are we going home? Back to mom's. You know, everybody knew what home was.
You're living with these little slivers under your fingernails all the time, always wondering what the right word is or the right approach.
Yeah. Oh, you know, another big difference is we talk in my mom's house. Everything came up. And there was a lot of bathroom humor and kid stuff that grown-ups just do not appreciate. But my mom sort of did.
So no poop jokes at your stepmother's
table?
No,
at my stepmother's, that was absolutely a strike. And those things actually made her sick. She would lose her appetite if we, you know, said snot at the table.
Did the two women, your mother and your stepmother, talk about each other when the other one wasn't there?
Oh, my God, yes. I do remember being in the car. The car was the worst because you couldn't just get up and walk away, and hearing my stepmom talk about my mom. It never troubled me to hear my mom talk about my stepmom, which is another one of those difficult positions stepmoms are in. Because you don't dog somebody's mom. That made me uncomfortable. I imagine it probably made them uncomfortable, too.
How long did this go on?
I don't know. It's always has been really two different worlds.
I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Story. Many years later, serious disease finally altered the family dynamic. Lisa Morgan's stepmother got breast cancer. Well, that was serious, but she survived. Then Lisa's mother found out she had ovarian cancer, stage 4.
And, you know, stage 5 is dead. There isn't stage 5. And so by the time my mom went into the hospital and we all found out she was sick, she was dying. She was very, very sick.
At this point, you and your sisters and your brother had kids, right? So
yes.
your mother was a grandmother,
mm-hmm,
and took a tremendous amount of pleasure in being a grandmother.
Yes.
And there was one granddaughter in particular she was close to.
My sister's daughter. My niece was and still is just a really vivacious, hyperactive tomboy of a little girl, just really neat little kid. And they would go to the thrift stores together and get costumes, or, you know, if need be, my mom would cut up her own clothes and make costumes. And because my sister was going through various troubles of her own,
right,
my mom ended up sort of raising her.
But something happened when your mother was quite ill. Someone decided that the granddaughter shouldn't go over and spend time with your mother?
My mom was saying, I want to see Bailey. And
Bailey's the granddaughter, yeah.
And she wasn't able to. Nobody, none of us could get a hold of, my sister's new in-laws had taken the girls, and nobody could get a hold of them. And when somebody finally did, they said that maybe my mom was too sick to see Bailey.
Then how did your stepmother come back into the picture?
She heard about that, and I think being a cancer survivor, when she heard, it made her really upset that somebody would say, you're too sick to see somebody that you love. And when she heard that, she just sort of took it upon herself to call and try to get a hold of the in-laws. They didn't answer. She hopped in her car, drove over there, and said, I'm bringing Bailey to see her grandma. And she did.
These two women who had been at each other's throats for now over 20 years as a result of a really messy divorce. Like, they really hadn't spoken a civil word.
Oh, really? Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, it's about as nasty as it could be in the way that you're describing it. Is that reasonable?
Yes.
And here's the stepmother who says, I'm going to do something nice, or I'm going to do the right thing. What was going on there?
You know, I don't know. I mean, that's what makes it such a really neat story, is it was just so unexpected that my stepmom took it upon herself to do it, and that allowed them to actually make eye contact, for one thing, and they hugged, they embraced.
Who did you hear that story from?
I heard
the encounter of the two women.
From my mom.
What did she tell you?
She said, yeah, well, she brought Bailey over, and she got kind of choked up, and my mom's sort of a sailor, kind of. She doesn't get choked up all that easily. She said, yeah, she brought her over, and she actually sat, and we chatted for a while, and then I got sick of her.
Like your mother had to put that little twist.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, my stepmom comes out pretty much smelling like a rose in this one, and my mom's still wicked.
Yeah, I'm just thinking that's the humor in her, that's the spirit in her, you know,
yeah,
right up to the
end. They did,
right?
Sit, and they sat and they chatted, and I don't know if they chatted about what it's like to be a cancer survivor. I don't know. And it probably wasn't even more than 15 minutes.
What did you learn from that?
I can't figure out a good lesson from it other than that people can surprise you and things don't make sense. My mom didn't change and become a changed person when she was dying. She was still witchy and naughty. And my stepmom didn't change into a new person.
She's not your closest personal
friend. She's still not my closest personal friend. But she did this nice thing, you know, this nice little gift that she gave to my whole family. And I don't know what kind of lesson you can take from that other than that it doesn't make sense.
The sense it made to me is, don't judge people. Like, don't make decisions that this could never happen, because in fact, it did. You
right.
know,
people can, they can surprise you, and she most certainly did. It was just this one of the very few really neat little things that happened while my mom was dying, and there weren't very many.
Lisa Morgan wrote in with her story. In fact, a number of our very best stories are the ones that come directly from you, usually to our website at thestory.org. After all, you know those stories. I don't. I rely on you to let me know about them. So send me a note to our website, thestory.org, or call and leave a short message on our telephone line at 1-888-966-9862. That's 1-888-966-9862. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Story.
The Story is a production of North Carolina Public Radio, WUNC, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill.
American Public Media.